Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'll call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much for being here. We do have a number of bills that are scheduled for today for public hearing and noted as possible work sessions. So what we're going to do is figure out, did you want to start with the 281? Or did you want to start, what did you want to start with?
I could probably go with the 125.
125.
It's already been through one.
All right, so what we're going to do is start with our first public hearing, which would be Senate Bill 125A. We'll open up a public hearing. Bill, give us the overview, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 125A comes to you from the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. It directs agencies in a contested case hearing to comply with the Service Members Civil Relief Act by giving notice to parties of the rights of active duty service members and include with the notice a statement of the service member's right to postpone the proceeding. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is federal law. It's been on the books in one form or another since the Civil War.
Okay. So we have two individuals to give testimony today, or at least have signed up. And it looks like Jess Barton and Mark, I cannot read your last
name. Hart?
Hollowing.
Chair, please. I forgot you.
I think you have the AA amendments that come through to the committee. They come from the Senate Veterans Affairs.
Okay. Sorry. All right, here. So we do have a set of amendments of the fact that we're also going to have them for consideration. So Jess, why don't you lead us off unless Mark was supposed to be the lead.
Go ahead and start. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm a member of the Bar's Executive Committee of its Military and Veterans Law Section. And I'm an adjunct instructor of criminal justice at Western Oregon University. This bill comes to you. It's kind of in follow-up to a 2009 bill called House Bill 2303, which put teeth into the Service Member Civil Relief Act. But we became aware, members of the bar that represent veterans and service members became aware of a possibility, a distinct possibility, that administrative agencies were possibly holding things like hearings, possibly in violation of service members' SCRA rights to have their proceedings, or this administrative proceedings, stayed pending their active duty deployments. That's one of the SCRA rights. I actually explained this in a little bit of detail on the second paragraph on page 2 of my written testimony. I should mention that this SCRA right to have legal proceedings or administrative proceedings stayed pending active duty deployments also applies in regular court proceedings. The Oregon Judicial Department has been in compliance with the SCRA since 2008. Other state agencies, such as the Bureau of Labor and Industries, has been in compliance with this SCRA right to a stay of proceedings since the BOLI's been in compliance with that requirement at least since 2005. Senate Bill 125 would bring all other state agencies into compliance with that SCRA requirement. The one thing I wanted to mention is that I've just recently become aware of these Dash 8 amendments, which would remove the emergency clause from the bill. I would strongly encourage the committee not to endorse that or to reject that amendment. It was specifically put in, the emergency clause was specifically put into the bill in the Senate Veterans Committee in recognition of the fact that there's going to be more deployments, active duty deployments of Oregon service members over the next, say, year and a half. It's important to get this legal protection into place now, to put the protections in place now so as to avoid any further violations by administrative agencies of service members' SCRA rights to have administrative proceedings stayed pending their active duty deployments. I also wanted to mention that the Senate Veterans Committee also amended the bill to allow administrative agencies some time to use up their stock of forms that now do not provide notifications to service members of their SCRA rights. That was done to avoid any kind of a fiscal impact of requiring agencies to throw away the forms that they have now and replace them with compliant forms. I met with some members of the bar and with facilitation of Mr. Taylor, met with some administrative agency folks in January of 2012, and they informed us that they would immediately take steps to start bringing their forms into compliance with the SCRA requirements. So I assume that by now they're closing in on having their forms in compliance with SCRA requirements. If the Dash 8 amendments were passed and the emergency clause were removed from the bill, then agencies would be allowed to, before January 1st, to replace forms that are not compliant, that do not comply with SCRA requirements, and therefore they would have a whole new stock of forms that are non-compliant, which they would be allowed to use up under the other provisions of the bill. So it's better to leave the emergency clause in place so as to ensure that compliant forms are put into use as soon as possible. And that actually concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. Unless the committee has any questions, I would just close by asking the committee first to reject the Dash 8 amendments and then to approve the bill as it was sent to you by the Senate Veterans Committee.
All right. Thank you. And Mark, why don't you give us your testimony, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. My name is Mark Holliday. I'm an attorney over in Beaverton. I'm also a member of the Veterans Committee with Mr. Barton here. And I'll keep my testimony short. I join Mr. Barton in his comments, and that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Very nice, very nice. All right. First question I have, and this will be first, I guess, to Bill or anyone, the Dash 8s, do we know who originated them and why they're here?
Chair, members of the committee, they came from the Senate Veterans Affairs staff. So I'm...
Okay.
Okay, so it's just, let's say, a pass-off you received. We don't know who actually brought them or why they're here, except that.
That's correct.
Okay. Other questions?
I would agree with the testimony. I think we do the bill as is.
Well, I'll just see if there's questions.
Yeah. No, that's not a question.
That was not. That was a comment. Very nice comment, too. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, obviously, we have not been in compliance at different times, and you mentioned the dates when we got into compliance with other agencies. My concern is if we were not in compliance, did the service people have recourse to actions that were taken out of compliance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roble, yes, in fact, under the SCRA, if a legal proceeding is held and some sort of in violation of SCRA requirements and some sort of adverse order is issued against the service member, when the service member comes off of active duty, he'll have a period of time, it's kind of complicated out, where he'll have a period of time to have the adverse order vacated. If he can show that had my SCRA rights not been violated, I would have had some type of defense and would have been able to defend against the adverse order, it would not have been issued. So you have to go back in and try to unwind the adverse order after the fact.
Follow up.
In the case of a foreclosure or whatever, would this apply in that kind of a proceeding? This is only for a personal note, and some people who have been deployed have gotten these notices and not been able to deal with them. I just wanted to know if...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roble, the answer is yes. Absolutely. That would be a judicial proceeding, typically.
Right.
So if a service member, there's a foreclosure action being brought against the service member, and he's not able to defend in the foreclosure proceeding. His property is foreclosed on while he's in Afghanistan. When he comes back, he'll be able to try to unwind the foreclosure proceeding and get his property back. There actually was a fairly notorious case about that came out of, actually I think out of the state of Montana, where somebody lost $1 million farm while on active duty deployment. And the case just wound up, I think the guy just lost everything. Proceedings like that, Senator Roblin, things like that really don't happen in Oregon any longer because of the passage in 2009 of House Bill 2303.
Bill.
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Barton has mentioned 2003, and what we really did at that time was put some significant teeth into this act. And basically, if I remember correctly, if the service member gives notice to the person, say, for example, the credit card company, that they are in active duty, and the credit card company persists in continuing to collect the debt in violation of the Service Member Civil Relief Act, they are entitled to attorney's fees against the credit card company. And I understand that a considerable number of cases were settled, and I see Mr. Garcia here from the Oregon National Guard.
Mr. Barton, my assumption is that if the service member notified the agency that they were on active duty and the agency persisted in pursuing the, whatever they're doing, and they got an attorney, they'd be entitled to attorney's fees against the agency. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Taylor, that is correct. In addition, the service member also would be entitled to an award of damages of at least $1,000 under House Bill 2303. It could be higher than that. The damage award could be higher than that.
All right. Any other questions? All right. I'm going to let you all step back. Amy Joyce has come forward saying that she may be able to give us some information regarding the Dash 8s.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I had not been planning on testifying today, but because of the discussion about the A8s, I thought I would come up and offer my the information that I have about that. And the information is this. I understand that the A8s came to you from staff from the Veterans Committee because the plan of that committee had been to lift the emergency clause, and because of the timing with the subsequent referral to this committee before it can move on to the floor, pardon me, they wanted to move the bill and have the emergency clause come off in this committee, pardon me again, which is why you received an amendment from committee staff herself. And my understanding of the reason for that is that a number of agencies, ODOT included, will require not only the pre-printed forms, the issue that Mr. Barton discussed, which is taken care of in the A engrossed version of the bill, but there are forms that are produced by computer system. In DMV's case, we're talking about driver license suspension type notices where the computer needs to be reprogrammed to take spit out the language that's contained in the engrossed version of the bill, and that the timing of this would be difficult with an emergency clause taking an effect on passage on signing by the governor. So that's the reason.
I appreciate the explanation. This is where I'm at on this based on what I've heard. I think what we need to do is we're not going to move the bill today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to have a small work group meet very quickly. What I want to know is how much time do we think agencies are going to need. What I want to do is enact the bill now so stuff can be worked on and we can actually get up to speed and then have a date certain prior to January of this next year, when it would come in, to give an opportunity to get this in place. I understand agencies need some time to do the paperwork, but I'd say right now, based on the temperature I feel at this committee, we're ready to pass the bill as is without the A8, but I'm willing to listen to what might be a reasonable amount of time before we have an actual implementation date. And so I know we have old computers, I know we have a lot of programming stuff, but the reality is we want to move this as quickly as we can.
Understood. Thank you, Chair.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I'd just say this may be a difficulty on an agency, but I would suggest deployment to Afghanistan is a difficulty in and of itself.
I appreciate that. Tony, did you want to say something? Looks like you're leaning forward.
Yes, sir.
You always get me anxious when I see you leaning.
For the record, Tony Garcia, on behalf of the Oregon Military Department. We're supportive of this bill, and I just want to answer or provide myself available for any questions for the committee. I just want to highlight the fact that next year there's a deployment that the 41st is going to be deploying. We have a large number of service members. So as the committee determines what amount of time is appropriate to enact this, the sooner is always the better. And I am the one attorney that is employed by the National Guard to assist all service members in the state of Oregon. And I've held this job over a number of times over the past 5 years. And we have to give a briefing to soldiers every year. And during this annual legal briefing, every soldier is supposed to know about the legal assistance office we have. And we just don't have that many service members, or it does come up where I have service members every year who are coming in who have no idea that we provide these services, that have no idea they have a lawyer at their disposal where they can ask these questions too. So in that regard, we are supportive of this measure because it just makes it more explicit to service members and indicates our office is the point of contact for them.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. The only other comment I would make is that nature abhors a vacuum, and if we give them until January, it'll take until January to redo the forms, and I think we need to put pressure on.
That's so. What I think we just did.
Yeah.
And we'll talk to Chair Boquist as to you know, his feelings on this as well. Thank you all very much for coming
forward.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 125. We're going to open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 188.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 188 comes to you from the governor for the Department of Corrections and authorizes the Oregon Youth Authority to establish a work release program. You have the dash one amendments in front of you, and I believe there may be a request to have the work session at a later date so we can get a dash two set of amendments.
All right. We have Shane Griggs and Karen Daniels. I want you to please come forward.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shane Griggs, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to testify in support of our bill, Senate Bill 188. There are two populations that are served at the Oregon Youth Authority, those who are under the legal and physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, and then those who are in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections but are housed at Oregon Youth Authority facilities. Senate Bill 188 ensures that persons committed to the legal custody of the Department of Corrections and housed at the Oregon Youth Authority are eligible for the work release programs and can participate in work crews. Currently, eligible youth offenders in the Oregon Youth Authority's legal custody receive hands-on work experience and/or opportunities to participate in work crews. Both of those opportunities help them finding employment upon release. At the same time, hundreds of youth that are in our legal or the Department of Corrections legal custody are not afforded that same opportunity. Research indicates employment experience is a critical component of successful transition back into our neighborhoods. Work release and work crew opportunities teach those valuable employment skills necessary for that successful transition. The Oregon Youth Authority does have many programs designed for youth to obtain those skills, and both departments, both the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority, recognize that need to ensure the opportunities are available for both populations. Some of the Department of Corrections inmates that are housed at the Oregon Youth Authority are serving mandatory minimum sentences and are not eligible for any form of work release or leave. The Dash 1 amendments affect Section 2 to ensure that those populations are not eligible for these opportunities. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions or wait at your convenience.
All right, thank you. Karen, why don't we take your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Daniels. I'm the Assistant Director for Facility Services with Oregon Youth Authority. This bill has been a collaborative effort between Oregon Youth Authority and DOC. We are in support of this bill. As Chain has just alluded to you, that our main purpose is to provide work experience, work skills, to ensure smooth transition, reentry, and a reduction of recidivism when youth are released to the community. We want to ensure a successful transition. We provide programs and opportunities to develop marketable job skills. And this population, which has been about an average of 350 DOC youth in OIA custody in 2012, are not eligible for these work programs. We have some programs going on within the secure perimeter, but there are a number of these work opportunities, vocational type training, that they are not currently eligible for. And this bill would simply allow that eligibility and allow us to program them in a similar manner that we presently program the OIA youth in. Some examples of those programs are contracts with Department of Transportation, Department of Forestry, wastewater treatment type vocational training, forestry crew, firefighting, etc. And as previously testified, Those youth that are sentenced under Measure 11 would not be eligible for the work release and temporary leave portion of this bill. So with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to address the committee.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Roblin.
Just one, and I assume that the dash one, that yeah, dash ones were really about the Measure 11, but it also any other crime. Are there other crimes that we have that are not Measure 11 that do not allow for the temporary custody to allow people to go out and do the work study? I mean, this bill looks like it just has a covering statement, but I just want to make sure. Because yeah. I agree. I think this is good for everybody personally.
Mm-hmm. Chair Przanski, Senator Roblin, the dash one amendments just precludes those Measure 11 offenders. Okay. So all other DOC legal custody youth and OIA custody would be eligible for those, which is only about 182 are non-Measure 11. So just under half of the population would be eligible then.
And I think just for clarification, when we say Measure 11, that doesn't necessarily mean a criminal offense that's been actually passed by the voters, because we, the legislature, have actually stuck within the statute that covers Measure 11. Even I just want to put that on the record that there are ones that we have deemed to be mandatory minimum that will also be covered.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And it sounds like at this point we're going to be waiting for a dash two.
Right.
And we'll be waiting. I understand that you'll be working with staff to get it rescheduled. All I can tell you is you've heard, you know, time's wasting.
Yes.
Haste is very important.
Yes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and let me just see if there's anyone else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 188. Not seeing anyone come forward. We'll close that public hearing. We're now going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 281. And I'm going to have Bill first give a overview. While he is, before he gives the overview, I'm going to go ahead and ask Lee Berger, Ryan Michaels, and Todd Delotto to please come forward. We will get Dr. Cohen on the phone in a moment.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 281 comes to Senator Boquist on behalf of the request of Todd Delotto. It includes in the definition of debilitating medical condition post-traumatic disorder for the purposes of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. Chair, members of the committee, we have the dash two amendments in front of you. It requires the Oregon Health Authority, when issuing a medical marijuana card, to notify the holder that compliance with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act is not a defense to federal prosecution. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just before this meeting, we got the dash three amendments that came in. And what they do currently, and I just quickly read them before the meeting, you annually request a new card. My quick reading of these would be that you would have to make this request every 60 days.
All right, so just for the record, it sounds like these last-minute amendments may have a conflict within there, which we'll have to be looking at. And if one of the parties that are at the table know of the origin of the dash threes and you wanted to intend this, I'm assuming you weren't wanting to have a conflict where a card is issued once a year, but they'd have to apply for it every 60 days. So with that, why don't we go ahead and get Dr. Cohen on the phone.
Chair Przanski, I've also received dash two amendments. I don't know if you have.
Chairman of the committee, I mentioned the dash
two. Oh, I apologize.
Let's go ahead and get Dr. Cohen on the phone.
Is there a way we could receive a copy of the dash two and dash three?
I can share mine with you if you like. Mm-hmm.
Let's just get him on the phone and then I'm get things going. I guess one of the questions is if you were requesters of any of those amendments, and if so,
Mr. Chair, the twos I think are from Senator Boquist and the threes are from me.
Okay.
This is Dr. Cohn.
Dr. Cohn, good morning. This is Floyd Przanski. I'm calling you from the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're live and we have you on the air now. We're about ready to start the testimony on Senate Bill 281, and we wanted to get you on the phone. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thank you, sir.
All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to first allow, I guess, who's going to go first?
Sorry. I'd like to go first if...
So what we're going to do is we'll take the panel first, and then Dr. Cohn, you'll be our fourth speaker. If you do not hear or cannot understand what's being said as the other testimony is coming in, if you all let me know, we'll do our best to make certain that you can follow that conversation before your testimony.
Thank you.
All right. Lee?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I live and work in Senator Shields and Representative Frederick's district. I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act. I've been coming to the legislature since, including in the 2005 session when the legislature enacted Senate Bill 10, or House Bill 1085. And I was the first lawyer on the advisory committee to that was created by that law. Mr. Michaels, to my extreme left, is the current lawyer on the committee. Mr. Delato is the chair of that committee. And Dr. Cohn, I think, recently resigned from the committee. They all have more patience than I do. I apologize to Senator Cruz, but I want to repeat what I testified about at the Health Committee, which is that, as I think the committee knows, the program has the authority to add conditions. And again, Mr. Delato and Mr. Michaels can speak more directly to current proposed changes, but I wanted to let you know how and why it is that we're here in the legislature seeking this change. And I'm testifying today on behalf of Compassionate Oregon. In 1998, the OMA passed. It was effective in December of 98. In 99, the first registry identification cards were issued. In early 99, a Rules Advisory Committee suggested administrative rules, including a rule for adding new conditions. And in 1999 and 2000, about 20 petitions were filed, including PTSD. Petitions requesting the addition of post-traumatic stress disorder. Consolidated hearings, and I use the term loosely, these were not due process hearings. They were held in private. There was secret evidence. The petitioners weren't allowed to present evidence, held with unanimous agreement to add anxiety. The Department of Human Services responded by adding adult Alzheimer's. Specifically as to PTSD, the panel's vote was split 4-4. The adult Alzheimer's continued as an administrative change and not a statutory change until Speaker Minnis was voted out of office, and then the legislature codified it. In March of 2005, March 28th, a registered nurse who worked as a psychiatric nurse named Ed Glick, who's filed written testimony today, filed a petition to reconvene the advisory panel for the purpose of inclusion of clinical depression, depressive symptoms, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, agitation, and insomnia to the list of OMA qualifying conditions based on the report of a psychiatric benefits survey he had conducted at the Compassion Center in Eugene, Oregon, entitled Patients Report Mood and Emotional Benefits from Cannabis Use. It isn't that there aren't patients currently who are involved in the medical marijuana program, who are registry identification patients, who have PTSD. It's that they qualify because they're lucky enough to have a debilitating physical condition that qualifies them. What we're missing is the people that don't have them. That.
Mr. Berger, hang on one second. Dr. Cohn?
Yes.
We're getting feedback because it sounds like you're listening to this maybe online as well.
Yes.
If you could either mute your phone for now or turn down your volume.
I'll mute.
Thank you. Go ahead, Lee.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. So used to being in court. Thank you, Chair Przanski. By letter dated December 13th of 2005, Dr. Grant Higginson, who was overseeing the program for DHS, summarily denied Petitioner Glick's petition is frivolous. It constituted final DHS action entitling Mr. Glick to petition either here in Marion County or in the county where he lives in Benton County for judicial review. So he did. He filed I filed on his behalf in a petition for review in Benton County Circuit Court, where Dr. Higginson offered to rescind the summary denial, which we rejected because of how unfair DHS's procedures were in 2000. In late June and early July of 2006, Anthony Johnson, who's now the director of New Approach Oregon, testified yesterday in the House on their legalization bill, and I met with then Assistant Attorney General and now Governor's Counsel Leonie Reeves to negotiate a more fair hearing procedure. That November, we submitted a proposed dismissal order, and the petition for judicial review was dismissed. January 26, on Nurse Glick's behalf, I filed with the Advisory Committee the renewed petition to add the 6 psychiatric conditions, and consistent with the administrative rules and Department of Human Services requests, on March 30th, Nurse Glick filed a detailed explanation justifying inclusion of these conditions, citing over 1,000 reports and patient studies. Public hearings were held July 27, August 13, and 24 based on additional rules and conditions required by DHS the day before the first hearing. The rules permitted a retired medical professor named Donald Austin unlimited time presenting the panel with the results of his so-called structured literature review. Nurse Glick presented expert testimony, including from folks who testified in the Health and Human Services Committee, which was limited in time and scope, along with lay testimony in support of the petition. Additionally, at the request of the panel, 2 drugs are bad addiction experts testified. Regarding the panel, part of the agreement Nurse Glick reached with the Attorney General's office was to be allowed input into who was on the panel. Panel selected by Dr. Higginson included 3 persons with knowledge of cannabis therapeutics, including Dr. Cohn, 3 persons without such knowledge, and Dr. Higginson. One of the prohibitionists, Diane Leah, was a social worker addiction specialist at DHS who offered as evidence at the hearing reports from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which even Dr. Higginson recognized had no place at the hearing. Nurse Glick's objection to Ms. Leah being part of the panel was rejected by the hearing facilitator and DHS, notwithstanding her obvious bias. Predictably, the 3 persons without training or experience in cannabis therapeutics voted against adding any of the conditions. 2 of the 3 with cannabis therapeutics voted for adding all of the conditions, and the 3rd voted for adding all except for clinical depression. Dr. Higginson suggested that the OMMP consider initiating a legislative concept for the 2011 session, here we are in 2013, to allow research on medical marijuana for PTSD in well-controlled situations. Of course, that never happened. DHS never moved forward on that. The final report was issued on October 20, 2009 by the facilitator, Jana Fussell. Nurse Glick filed a rebuttal on October 30. On March 3rd, Dr. Cohn issued a notice of intent to deny. Nurse Glick sought reconsideration on March 24, 2010, requested a hearing. On April 5th, DHS referred the of 2010, DHS referred the request to the Office of Administrative Hearings, who appointed an administrative law judge named Carrie Meerdink to decide the matter. On July 27, 2010, ALJ Meerdink decided he had jurisdiction to hear the matter and ruled that the scope of the hearing was limited to whether DHS abused its discretion in denying the petition, which functionally denied the petition. And on January 7 of 2011, he allowed DHS's motion for summary determination. On April 12, Dr. Cohn of 2011, Dr. Cohn issued a final order denying Nurse Glick's petition. He had the right to appeal this to the Court of Appeals, but chose not to do so because of the futility in doing so, which is to say really just 2 things to this committee. The first is we have exhausted all other remedies other than a legislative solution. There is no other solution to adding PTSD other than the legislature doing it. And I think that the hearing before the Senate Health and Human Services Committee and this hearing today is really Nurse Glick's opportunity for a full and fair hearing before neutral and fair decision makers. So on his behalf and on behalf of all Oregonians using cannabis therapeutically to treat their post-traumatic stress, veterans and non-veterans alike, who don't otherwise qualify for the protection of the OMA, but especially for the veterans, I respectfully request the committee move this bill forward with a due pass, and I ask that you do it without either of the 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendment offered by Senator Boquist would require the health authority to give notice to any patient who applies for the program that Compliance with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act is not a defense to prosecution for a felony-level offense involving marijuana under federal law, and if you're convicted of a felony-level offense under federal law, that will restrict your right to possess a firearm under Oregon statutes, and it makes you a felon in possession of a firearm under federal law. That's true, but it's what's also true, and really the point, I hope everybody remembers, of the Medical Marijuana Act is to exclude from the state criminal justice system that narrow piece of the big pie that is the injustices of the war on drugs. Those people that everybody agrees shouldn't be a part of that, and accept people who are using cannabis therapeutically within the limits and not doing any of the things that are opposed from felony convictions in state court. And when we're talking about enforcement of the marijuana laws nationally and in Oregon, certainly as to possessory offenses, overwhelmingly the prosecutions are in state court. So the only reason to include this kind of a warning to people who are going to apply to be scared of losing their Second Amendment rights is to dissuade people from getting protection from arrest and prosecution under state law. And that entirely defeats the purpose of the Medical Marijuana Act. The sheriffs raised similar arguments in the concealed handgun litigation, which I handled, and I'd be certainly glad to answer questions about that.
We've got a lot of people.
I understand. I wanted to speak real briefly to the 30 to the dash 3 amendments, the 60-day. I appreciate the opportunity, Senator Cruz, to have met with you and discussed this. I went looking. I couldn't find anything anywhere in Oregon law that requires a physician to meet with a patient every 60 days to prescribe Schedule II controlled substances. Although marijuana has been rescheduled as a Schedule II controlled substance, the attending physicians opining that a person might benefit from medical marijuana and reporting the diagnosis of a debilitating medical condition is not a prescription under federal law. Prescriptions are regulated by the Drug Enforcement Agency. That's a little B at the bottom of the script. That's the DEA number, the physician's DEA number. And there isn't anything that precludes a physician from providing a patient with several 60-day prescriptions. So I discussed actually this proposal with Rick Baer, who is the retired internal medicine physician who is co-chief petitioner of the act, and he described it as a proposal to limit the medical marijuana program to the 1% that, you know, anybody earning less than $40,000 a year couldn't afford to go to a physician every 60 days. And again, and respectfully, Senator Cruz, I couldn't find any Oregon law requiring this. And although there's a limit to how far out a physician can prescribe medication, Schedule II medication, it doesn't limit the physician from providing multiple copies of the prescription. And in any event, because marijuana has such a high LD50, because it's unlike prescription medications, no one's ever died from using marijuana. It's just not appropriate in this context. And that's all I have, and I appreciate your patience. Thanks, Chair Przanski.
Thank you. Who wants to go second?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Todd Delato. I'm from Philomath, Oregon. I am a horticultural scientist specializing in cannabis as well as a public policy consultant. I'm the president of CAN Research, Education, and Consulting in Corvallis. I'm a constituent of Senator Boquist, and he introduced this bill on my behalf. I also chair the advisory committee on medical marijuana, which advises the Oregon Health Authority on the administrative aspects of the program. We didn't want to take up too much of your time this morning, so we encouraged people to limit the public comment so we're not flooding your hearing room today. So I strongly encourage each one of you to review the audio archive testimony from the February 7th House Senate Healthcare Committee hearing. There's a wealth of compelling testimony on medical evidence and patient testimony as well. That's very valuable. As Mr. Berger stated, the Oregon Health Authority is charged by statute to promulgate rules to review petitions to add conditions to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. He eloquently explains how that is flawed. From a scientific perspective, the rules are proven inadequate for ensuring a fair review and decision-making process for the following reasons. Because of lack of protection against bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest in both the panel selection criteria as well as the decision to approve or deny petitions. Lack of the requirement for the decision to be based upon scientific evidence. The meetings of the expert panel were not public hearings. And the lack of consideration of the effective federal ban on research, on medical research with cannabis by the DEA, FDA, and National Institute of Drug Abuse. In June of last year, the Public Health Division was finally convinced that these flaws necessitated an overhaul of the review process. Thus, a Rules Advisory Committee was convened, which I was appointed to recommend changes to the administrative rules with the goals of establishing protections against bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest. That goal was not met. To enhance accountability and transparency, that goal was partially met. To establish clear criteria for decision making, that was partially met. Establishing a fair selection criteria of experts, that was partially met. And to streamline the process for greater efficiency and cost savings, that was met. The Oregon Health Authority's Committee on Medical Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, which I chair, unanimously and enthusiastically supports the addition of PTSD to the list of qualifying conditions, as well as supporting the rule change goals that I just stated, as well as the Rules Advisory Committee, which I was appointed to, and also to most people who testified during the public comment period during that rulemaking process. In the finalized text, as I noted previously, only one goal was fully met. Most were partially met. But the most important goal, to protect against bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest, was not met at all. And this is very important in the evaluation of evidence and policy making with cannabis. Because this rule does not ensure an objective review of future petitions to add debilitating medical conditions, and due to the bias that existed in the prior two petition processes, patients who suffer from post-traumatic stress and other debilitating medical conditions are still unable to rely upon the administrative process to consider their condition fairly. Therefore, the addition of debilitating conditions by statute is the only remaining way to ensure people suffering from medical conditions that are safely and effectively treated with medical cannabis can be protected for their use of medical cannabis. So I strongly urge you to support Senate Bill 281 with a due pass recommendation so that Oregon can become a place where returning combat vets and others suffering from terrible traumas can feel more safe and protected here at home in Oregon. And to also address the two amendments, I support this, you passing this bill without those dash amendments. Specifically to the dash 3, requiring someone to renew their card every 6 days. As someone who has been advising the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program on the administrative aspects since 2001, for the very first time, the program manager was able to report that they were able to return cards, to issue cards within the statutory requirements of 30 days for the first time since the program was created in 1999. This staff undergoes a tremendous backlog of applications, which has only recently improved. So just the administrative headache of turning over an application in 60 days is unfathomable, not to mention the effects upon particularly the lowest income and uninsured for having to go see a doctor every 60 days just to sign some paperwork. I think that decision should be left to a doctor and the patient to decide what the best course of follow-up care is. So please support this bill with a do pass recommendation. I'm happy to be available for any questions you have.
All right, Brian, you're next. And for you and for Dr. Cohen, we have seven other people besides these two that still need to testify. So your remarks hopefully will be a little bit shorter so we can get the other people that are here who want to testify get their own record too. Brian?
I'll try to be brief. My name is Brian Michaels. I'm an attorney in Eugene, Oregon. Senator Przanski is my senator. Myself and the next witness, Dr. Cohen, wrote an article for the Register Guard back in October. Did you folks receive that this morning?
We do.
Okay. I am a member of the ACMM, the Advisory Committee to the Medical Marijuana Program, and I would like to start first with the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments before I get into the bulk of my remarks on PTSD. I find Dash 2 to be almost humorous in the sense of I'm not quite sure why the author of this Dash amendment was so concerned with the firearm issue as the prime purpose of informing these folks about federal prosecution. I want to know a connection, and I don't see it, why that would be something the Oregon Health Department would talk about in its literature to its participants. We talk about firearms. Where did that, I'm not sure why that would be the issue. Federal prosecution is already informed by the OMMP to participants that it's what they're doing is against federal law. I'm not sure why that is insufficient and why firearms came to be an issue. But on to Dash 3, I need to echo Mr. Delato's remarks, having been with the ACMM for some time. It's amazing how much work their staff does. They've had some staff cutbacks like everyone else in the state. To increase their workload sixfold, I'm certain whoever introduced this Dash 3 amendment had not consulted the OMMP, who would be the ones actually doing the job, because I'm sure they would be here telling you, please don't do this to us. This is borderline insanity. This is borderline torture, because we can't do what we can now, which is different than consider the people, whether they're disabled or they're working. How difficult is it going to be for them to go every 60 days to a doctor? They have to take off work, they have to charge their insurance company, they may have to charge Oregon Health Plan, they may have to charge Social Security, they have to set an appointment with the doctor every 60 days. Well, essentially, as soon as they get their card, they're going to have to begin the process of reapplying almost immediately. It's a thinly veiled punitive amendment to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. On to my remarks about PTSD. PTSD, as you may be aware, is an identifiable, recognized medical condition. It has identifiable diagnosable symptoms, including night terror, severe antisocial behavior, a constant state of anxiety, unfamiliarity with yourself and surroundings, and a constant state of instability. This causes great havoc on one's personal life, one's ability to work, one's family, one's friends. These people live in a tortured world all day long. And make no mistake about it, most of the people that suffer from PTSD are our veterans. Now, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, or whether you were for the wars or against the wars, we're all for and honor our troops coming home. And make no mistake, this bill is about serving our veterans. It's not about the politics of marijuana. That's a misdirection. Because in reality, you're not going to really be increasing the number of people who use marijuana. Because any one of us, if faced with this disease, if faced with this horrible life, was given the opportunity to choose marijuana as a treatment, which is the only noticeable, identifiable, effective treatment. If you had the choice to be in living hell or live like a normal person with your family, you would take it. And let's face it, most of us would.
And so what you're really doing is saying, am I wanting a veteran to choose between being a criminal or am I being treated? And so you're really not increasing the amount of marijuana because most of them are going to use it anyway. What you're doing is you're decreasing the amount of their doors that get broken down, their children that get taken away from them, their parents that get put into prison. You're giving our veterans the freedom to do what they need to do, to live among us safely and healthy. You're not really increasing any marijuana use. It's a really important point because that is the misdirection that people who are against this amendment are going to say. And it's just not true. If any one of you lived that way, you would use marijuana. You have to. It's taught you not to. So we're only asking that you let our veterans be non-criminal citizens. They've served us so much, and they've come back so ill, so disabled, so tortured. Why can we not give them this one thing? There really is no answer. It's really a no-brainer. Ask any vet who has PTSD and has used marijuana, and they'll tell you that. And that's all I have.
All right, thank you. Dr. Cohen?
Hello. I'll try to be brief and not repeat what others have said. I'm a psychiatrist who had worked 35 years at the jail, at Lane County Mental Health, Marion County Mental Health, and Serenity Lane during much of that time. And I talked with patients, and families confirmed the fact that for many of these folks who were in jail, for instance, for minor infractions or drug-related offenses having to do with cannabis, that they were stable and manageable and productive at home when they had access to the medication, and when they didn't for one reason or another, they became a risk to the community and a real problem around the house. The availability of having this medication without the risk of incarceration was something that families repeatedly requested to me, although I had no ability to accomplish that at all. I wanted to say something about the proposed amendment of 60-day repeats, which really is not revisits, which really is not a requirement of any scheduled material that I know of. They do only allow 60-day prescription for Schedule IIs, but physicians get around that by writing a half a dozen prescriptions with different dates so that the patient doesn't have to come back for a year. Marinol is Schedule III. It has none of these kinds of requirements, and it's a riskier medication and a more difficult medication to utilize than cannabis by inhalation. Schedule IV medications, which have none of these requirements, include Taulin, a potent opiate, Tramadol, Soma, and benzodiazepines, which are addictive, potentially lethal in overdose, and quite risky, and physicians write those for better or for worse for extended periods. If a 60-day revisit is required, doctors are going to refuse to be involved because they're already busy and they don't need additional busy work that might thrust requirements onto them. And patients, some of them having difficulty mobilizing and coming out into the community, are going to be hesitant themselves to make this kind of commitment. I think that amendment is disingenuous and would appear to make the possibility of using cannabis for PTSD practically impossible for a large percentage of individuals who might otherwise benefit from the medication. I really welcome any questions if individuals want to ask anything specific about my experience over the years at the jail and at treatment facilities attending to these folks.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Let me see if there's any questions here on the panel. Thank you, gentlemen, for stepping forward. Dr. Cohen, you're more than welcome to stay online if you want to listen at this point. It sounds like you may already have us up on your computer. So what is your choice?
I'll listen on the computer. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your time. Have a wonderful day. All right, folks, we have a number of people that still want to give testimony. I need to ask one question of two people. Mary Hoke, you've checked the box of living more than 100 miles from here. Can you please tell me where you live?
Medford, Oregon.
All right, please come forward. And Lori Duckworth, same question.
Medford, Oregon.
All right, y'all two come on up. We have a courtesy rule for those who travel over 100 miles. And Jennifer it looks like Valley, maybe? Valley. Why don't you come up with them? And ladies, I hate to tell you this. I want to try to get another panel up. I have about 18 minutes at most.
We'll make it brief.
That'd be wonderful.
Thank you.
I want to make sure
Senator
everyone gets a chance to testify.
I came on the 7th, and I testified about my husband,
For
William.
Each of you, I need you to give us your name first and then your testimony, please.
I'm Mary Hoke, and I'm glad to be here, Ann. I testified on the 7th before the committee about my husband, William Hoke, and I would like to reiterate how incredibly important marijuana was to his life. He would have not survived had he not had marijuana in his life. They made him quit once to be able to have medication, and it made him suicidal because of that medication. It would have been impossible for him to go on a repeated basis of 60 days to the doctor to obtain something to say that he could smoke. He did not do well in public. He stayed home mainly. My daughter also has PTSD from childhood molestation, and she's got agoraphobia. For her to go to the doctor, she makes 5 appointments and maybe goes once of those 5 appointments because it takes her that much to build up to get there. It's for those people that suffer is that it is a horrific thing to try and talk to other people about what's happening to them because they don't want to share, they don't trust anyone. So it's even more difficult allowing them to have this for a period of time that 1 year and not making them repeatedly go to the doctor is got to be the most sensible thing for those people. Thank you.
Mary, thank you very much. Who'd like to go next?
Thank you for hearing us today. My name is Lori Duckworth. I'm the executive director of Southern Oregon Normal in Medford, Oregon. We successfully sat next to the federal courthouse, as many of you may know, for 4 years. I have a member base of 4,000 members. I service a lot of veterans there at the community center. Many of them have to choose between their pharmaceutical medications and cannabis. Even though the VA has lackadaisied a bit on their approach with cannabis. We hear often that there is such a high number of OMMP patients that qualify under the chronic pain diagnosis. They must use that diagnosis, but they're truly treating their PTSD. We are 14 years into this program, and we truly need this qualification. We need this diagnosis so that we don't have to qualify those veterans, and not just veterans, but many, many individuals, such as Mary just spoke about her daughter, my husband, who is not a veteran, who is a survivor of childhood molestation. They need this diagnosis so that they don't have to go under that cloud of chronic pain. I ask that you please consider passing this without the amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. And Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me here. I think it's important to understand that when you leave an abusive relationship, your chances of dying by violent homicide go up by 80%. And in a hostage situation, if your captor gets you into a car, your chances of survival immediately drop by 85%. The first time I left an abusive relationship, I was almost 19 years old, and I was stalked for a month and a half. And when he caught me, he kept me for 5 hours, and I went down the tunnel, and my life flashed before my eyes, and I'm pretty sure I was dead for a minute. and he brutally raped me, and I spent the next 20 years having nightmares and screaming terrors and not coping well with folks. But I was lucky he let me go, because 6 months later, another stalker happened to take notice of me. And when he caught me, he kept me for almost 6 months, beating me, raping me, drugging my food. He got me pregnant, because running away is harder with a baby on your arm. And I actually had to hide in a swamp for 2 weeks to get away from him. And when I was diagnosed with advanced cancer, I was told that if I wanted my child to go to anyone but him, I would have to get his permission. So that made death not an option, and I had to go through a lot of things that I would have rather just given up and died, but didn't get to. Marijuana has had a huge impact on my life. It's made it possible for me to cope with the night terrors. It's made it possible for me to cope with the flashbacks. It's helped me to gain 40 pounds and stop seeing my doctor for 50 hours every year. It's changed my entire life. I'm the only person in my family, my generation, that didn't join the military. And I know how those folks feel about the PTSD, and it's a huge stigma. There's no shame in talking about cancer, but there's a lot of shame in talking about rape. And even in sexual aggressors who didn't rape me, usually they tattled on me for fighting back. And it made the PTSD worse. These things have been going back 40 years. I was 5 years old the first time someone tried to kill me. This doesn't just happen to soldiers. Children are abused. Adult women are abused. It's a much larger population, and we don't speak out because of the stigma. 80% of rapes are not reported. And I just needed you to understand that it's not just soldiers. There's a lot of people that need this.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming forward and telling your story. Is there any questions for this panel? Ladies, thank you very, very much. Okay, I have next
thank
panel
you.
Will be Jared Townsend, Nick, I believe it's Billups, and Anthony Taylor. And whoever would like to start, go ahead.
I'm Jared Townsend. I'm a combat veteran of the Iraq War. Today, I'm here for five of my friends that couldn't be here. And the reason that they died was because they were prescribed pharmaceuticals from the VA in massive doses, and they ended up overdosing and dying. At that point, I chose not to take pharmaceuticals anymore, and practically in fear of my life. And ultimately, I believe that's why I've been able to be a productive member again of society. I'll be graduating in a couple months, but I couldn't have done any of this without medical marijuana. Also, I'd just like to bring up a huge disparity between what you see and what we actually feel. I've been waiting for medical discharge for 6.5 years. I have stacks of paperwork up to here, and I've been nothing but fought with the whole time. And my choice to use medical marijuana has been a conflict in the National Guard, and I have not been going for the last year and a half. But there's really no choices. Do I choose between death and living in hell? You give me Prozac, that takes 4 weeks to freaking kick in. I can go smoke a bowl of pot and be fine and normal and functional again. Or something that'll kill me. And I choose not to do that. But I feel there's no representation for us. We go fight your wars. We come home. We live in hell. We want to commit suicide every day or shoot someone. I've gone to Congress about my medical discharge, and there's been no help. We're still waiting. My estimated time in service, I should be out before any of this even starts to go through. But then the National Guard says, hey, you're going to lose your benefits if you're smoking pot. So now all the benefits that I just fought for to get for 3.5 years, I could potentially lose all that. And I'm not sure if you check the suicide rates with veterans, but they're pretty freaking high. What's not working is the VA and the pharmaceuticals. What works is medical marijuana. I wish I could stop 5 of my friends before they went and killed themselves and said, hey, smoke a bowl of pot and let's go talk about this. But I can't do that anymore. Their children can't do that. If you think it's a joke, it's not. And I don't care about the politics of this. Let's save our soldiers that fought for you. It's time to fight for them. And with the 60-day thing, that's not going to happen. Because what am I going to do, go renew my card every 60 days? Well, there's going to be no doctors to renew it because they're so busy with everyone else's. It's not going to work. I think it's just a ploy to clog the system. And how is the revenue going to work with that? I mean, I'm a finance major. It's pretty easy to see that by the time I get my card, I'm applying for another one. I got to schedule the appointment, which takes a week and a half. Now you're messing with the medicine. So now I'm going in between breaks if I don't want to smoke it illegally. Oh, then I have more pressure from the federal side. So I'm just fighting everyone, and it's hell. I'm tired of fighting. I've already done enough of it in Iraq. So I'll just ask you guys to fight for us. Find it in your hearts to stop a suicide.
Thank you. Nick?
All right, my name is Nick Phillips. And to start this out, I had a question for the panel up here. How many of you have served in the United States military? Any branch, doesn't matter. None?
I was in the National Guard. My daughter's in the Navy.
Your daughter's in the Navy? Okay. Do you do any combat tours, sir?
I hopefully not, because she's going to be in a nuclear submarine.
So. I was talking about you, sir.
Nope.
No? Okay. That's just my entry into, you guys can't really grasp what we go through when we come home. Really tough for me to be up here right now, I'll admit that. I didn't make the last one because I didn't feel comfortable being here. Little backstory on me, 2009, 2010, I served in Iraq. Lost a few good buddies over there, along with Mr. Townsend here at our home unit. We've lost a few up there as well, suicides, drinking and driving, drug overdoses. Along with Townsend, if I could have stopped him and said, try this instead, I'd still be here. So on top of all the stress that I deal with coming home with my wife and son, I have their deaths on my shoulders as well because I didn't go out of my way to try to get them to do that. Without medical marijuana, I have it for my back. It's not why I use it. I use it for my head. It levels me out. It makes me think before I react. Now, without that, I'm a very harsh fella. I lose my mind pretty easily. I rear-ended a car when I was living with Jared Townsend. Flipped some guy's grocery cart in the store. That was when I was going through my phase of trying to stop smoking marijuana. It didn't work out for me. The reason I tried to stop, I popped hot when I came home from Iraq for marijuana. Lost my ass. Demoted me. I stayed at PFC for 2.5 years prior to ETSing. When I tried to re-enlist, get everything back on track, they said no. Why? Because of my back and my PTSD. So for them to deny me, but yet you guys not be able to pass this to help us, I'm really at a loss of words. I mean, you talk about supporting the veterans, but you load them up on pills when they come home and they die. That's it. They just die. You're not taking the proactive actions to stop that. I mean, I randomly get bottles of pills in the mail. I don't know what they are because they switch my prescriptions so much. I have 30 bottles of pills sitting in my cabinets that I don't use. My wife hates marijuana, loves when I smoke because I'm normal. That's all I got to say. I can't talk anymore.
Nick, thank you very much for coming forward and sharing your story. That's me.
Chairman Przanski, thanks for hearing our testimony today. And members of the committee, my name is Anthony Taylor. I am the director of Compassionate Oregon. And I am a veteran, I'm a cardholder, and I'm also on a pain management contract. What's happening at the federal level with the Veterans Administration is they're beginning to ease their policy for patients that choose to use cannabis in conjunction with their other medications, whether it's for pain or for traumatic stress. And to date, none of the national veteran service organizations have taken a position on PTSD, and there are members of American Vets for Medical Marijuana working with these service organizations to get resolutions drafted so that their support becomes evident and they begin to start supporting efforts to allow cannabis to be used in conjunction with other medications. And because of this, the Veterans Administration is kind of throwing it back into the laps of the state because their hands are tied. You can't take controlled substances onto the federal property. There has been these issues where you're denied your medication or services in general because you're a cannabis patient. And so I would hope that this committee, as well as the legislature as a whole, would take the action to adopt this measure and allow the states to start showing the Veterans Administration that they're okay with this, to allow the Veterans Administration to continue to ease their policies. A recent report by the Army Surgeon General has indicated that the level 2 drugs that these gentlemen have been prescribed in most instances are for the most part non-effective, and that cannabis, not the attorney, Army Surgeon General's opinion, but that cannabis can be used in conjunction and is in fact one of the safer, more effective treatment modalities for PTSD.
Anthony, yes, I need to do this. We're already out of time. I need you to please summarize. I have one more person that needs to give a testimony.
Quickly, I would just like to say that We need to take this action to help not only our veterans, but the ladies that spoke before, and also our first responders. They are presented with trauma as much as anybody. So I would ask the committee to please consider passing this bill without the proposed amendments. And thank you, folks, for allowing me to testify.
Anthony, thank you very much, and thank you for summarizing. Gentlemen, again, thank you very much. I can only imagine the difficulty you have being before us, but I can tell you your testimony is valuable. Without it, we would not be as informed as we are. So thank you very much for coming forward today.
Thank you, son.
Sir, folks.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Senator Betsy Close. I'm opposed to Senate Bill 281. Colleagues, an old saying, count the cost. Before you do anything, count the cost. I would urge you to do so on this bill and others we are considering regarding marijuana use. Please consider the other side of this. Having been a teenager when marijuana first appeared en masse in the late 60s, I have seen the devastation of the long-term effects of chronic marijuana use. For example, a close relative of mine who is nearing old age was a Phi Beta Kappa in Wisconsin. He got a BA, very bright man. And he was in graduate school in California when he began to smoke dope. At 40, he could no longer add. And he now has COPD, a bronchitis emphysema disease that is fatal. There is no cure. He was never able to conceive a child, and he lives on Social Security. Marijuana does damage the body, and especially the brain. I'd like to call your attention to a research article that I have kept for years, for decades. I give it out to young people, teenagers mostly, I know, who are smoking marijuana. It has two parts. It's called Marijuana Alert, Brain and Sex Damage, and Marijuana Enemy of Youth. It summarizes research that was done many years ago, but I don't know why it wouldn't be true today, because the marijuana is even stronger now. The International Symposium on Marijuana was held in Reims, France in 1978. It included 50 researchers from 14 countries. And they presented studies about marijuana's injurious effects on reproduction, lungs, cellular metabolism, and the brain. In 1979, there was a conference in Virginia sponsored by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which revealed more evidence of harmful effects on the reproductive system. And 3 months later, there was one done, New York University Medical School, dangers caused by chronic smoking of marijuana. Just to very briefly summarize, I know we're out of time. One of the problems is that marijuana is often compared to alcohol, that they're the same. They are not. Alcohol is water-soluble, if you remember from your chemistry in high school. THC is fat-soluble. It is stored in the fat tissues of the body for many years. And the main organ that has fat surrounding it is the brain and also the sex organs. This research found that with research that was done on rhesus monkeys, that the synapse in the brain began to widen, and there is brain damage. This is all in the article, so I won't go into detail. The reproductive organs are affected. The sperm count goes down. The number of eggs that are released by women decreases. That would explain why my relative was never able to conceive a child. And this is all documented by research. So, in conclusion, you know, are we going to go from PTSD to COPD? Is that the answer here? It has been said today, let's save the soldiers who fought for you. Does this save them? I'm not sure that's true. I want them to have a better life. I don't want them to depend on drugs the rest of their lives. I grieve, as we all do, over the rapes, the abuses, the terror of combat. My father was a World War II vet. But are drugs our only solution for our deep problems? Is this the best we can do? There are other therapies than drugs. Are we pursuing those? Are our vets going to be more safe and protected? We have to answer that question. All drugs have side effects. This drug has documented brain damage and sex damage. And that is our decision here. Possible sterility. And lives that never realized the great potential that is in them. And that is the sadness that I feel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Close. So just for the record, what we have been handed to us, which will become part of the record, is a Reader Digest reprint entitled Marijuana Alert. It looks like it's copyrighted in 1979. So that will be part of the record. What I'm going to tell everyone, first I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 281. We have, we're getting to the point of where we're, let's say, our time is becoming more tight. This bill, Senate Bill 281, will be scheduled for work session next Wednesday, a week from today. SJR 34, which is a bill that was scheduled for public hearing and possible work session, will be carried over until next Wednesday for both public hearing and work session. This is one that the chair has brought forward for sitting judges as well as JAG members who want to be able to teach in public law schools but find that they're in a conflict. We'll go over that next week. And I understand from what we've already said on the record, Senate Bill 188 is more than likely will be scheduled for a work session later, but we have to wait until amendments are done. And 125, we still need to take action on that, correct?
Chair, members of the committee, I met with the parties outside. We talked about an effective date of September 1. It's an easy amendment to get.
So we're going to go ahead and set that for next Wednesday as well. That would be Mr. Taylor's next day, which I believe, if I got that right, all of those for next Wednesday is the April 10th. All right.
Didn't we do something with SJR 34, that concept?
This is the fourth time we've had it. It always gets hung up over in the House.
Okay. No, it's...
So it'll be very quick. We just need to, we're not going to waste the time today since y'all were so gracious to stay the extra time. So everyone that was here, I want to thank you again for being here. I know for many of you who testified today, this is not what you want to be doing. I can understand the hesitation you may have, but again, I welcome your testimony. It is very important to put this on the record, and we'll have this matter up next week. With that, we're closed. Thank you.